Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. Om Namo Bhagavate Vasudevaya. So we are reading from the Bhagavad Gita, as it is, from the 9th chapter, entitled The Most Confidential Knowledge, text number, I have to choose one, I haven't chosen. Anyway, let's take one. 28. Subha subha falerevam mokshase karma bandhanae sanyase yoga yuktatma vimuktumam upareshyasi. Translation. In this way, you will be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious results. With your mind fixed on me and this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. In the previous verse, it was the famous verse, Yat kurosi yat asnasi yat juhosi dadasi yat yat tapasyasi konteya tat kuruswa mat arpanam. Whatever you do, whatever you eat, whatever you offer or give away, and whatever austerities you perform, do that, O son of Kunti, as an offering to me. So the present verse is, in this way you will be freed from bondage to work, and its auspicious and inauspicious result. With your mind fixed on me in this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. Purport. One who acts in Krishna consciousness under superior direction is called Yukta. The technical term is Yukta Vairagya. This is further explained by Rupa Goswami as follows. Anasakta sevisayan yataramupajunjataha nirbanda krishna sambandha yukta vairagya muchate bhakti rasamrita sindhu 2.255. Rupa Goswami says that as long as we are in this material world, we have to act. We cannot cease acting. Therefore, if actions are performed and the fruits are given to Krishna, then that is called yukta vairagya. Actually situated in renunciation, such activities clear the mirror of the mind, and as the actor gradually makes progress in spiritual realization, he becomes completely surrendered to the Supreme Personality of Godhead. Therefore, at the end, he becomes liberated, and this liberation is also specified. By this liberation, he does not become one with the Brahma Jyoti, but rather enters into the planet of the Supreme Lord. It is clearly mentioned here, Mam Upaisyasi. He comes to me, back home, back to Godhead. There are five different stages of liberation, and here it is specified that a devotee who has always lived his lifetime here under the direction of the Supreme Lord, as stated, has evolved to the point where he can, after quitting this body, go back to Godhead and engage directly in the association of the Supreme Lord. Anyone who has no interest but to dedicate his life to the service of the Lord is actually a sannyasi. Such a person always thinks of himself as an eternal servant, dependent on the supreme will of the Lord. As such, whatever he does it for the benefit of the Lord. Whatever action he performs it as service to the Lord. He does not give serious attention to the fruit of activities or prescribed duties mentioned in the Vedas. For ordinary persons, it is obligatory to execute the prescribed duties mentioned in the Vedas, but although a pure devotee who is completely engaged in the service of the Lord may sometimes appear to go against the prescribed Vedic duties, actually it is not so. It is said, therefore, by Vaishnava authorities that even the most intelligent persons cannot understand the plans and activities of a pure devotee. The exact words are Tare Vakya Kriya Mudra Vigaya Nambujaya, Chaitanya Charitamrita, Madhya 23.39. A person who is thus always engaged in the service of the Lord, or is always thinking and planning how to serve the Lord, is to be considered completely liberated at present, and in the future his going back Home, back to Godhead, is guaranteed. He's above all materialistic criticism, just as Krishna is above all criticism.
Om Jnana Timurandasya Ginandana Salakaya Chakshur Militam Yena Tasmai Shri Gurave Namaha Shri Chaitanya Manobhistam Stapitam Yena Bhutale Swayam Rupa Kadamayam Dadati Swapadantikam.
This movement is completely transcendental, and therefore it is meant for transcendental personalities. So, therefore, the idea is that devotees in this movement are not at all depending on material considerations and calculations, but rather completely surrender to Krishna and depend on Krishna. So, of course, at the same time, a devotee is not just exclusively waiting for Krishna to send him something to eat, but rather he's doing something himself also. He does some work. So we must work in this world, and as we are working according to our own intelligence and according to our own insight and ideas. But we always know that Krishna is from another realm, that Krishna is from the spiritual world, and therefore not bound by the limitations or the laws of material nature. And that therefore, if Krishna desires so, he can interfere at any moment in time and make things happen that go completely against the laws of material nature. And we see that the pastimes of Krishna are full of such amazing feats. I've been mentioning some of these supernatural things in the last few days, how Krishna was planting diamonds and growing plants that could give more diamonds from that. We know how Lord Chaitanya put the seed of a mango in the ground, which turned into a tree which always had delicious fresh mangoes in any season without a seed or without a peel. And the devotees could have as many as they liked. So these are just all different activities where Krishna shows his supernatural feature. So we see that sometimes the devotees of Krishna are also able to do supernatural things, quite amazing feats they can perform. And how is this all possible? Prabhupada, of course, was certainly a great mystic yogi, although we have never seen that Prabhupada was flying around the room. We may hear such stories sometimes. There was a book written by one yogi which became quite famous. It was called the Autobiography of a Yogi. And he was in his book writing that one day he came in his room, and he saw, and he couldn't see his guru. Then he looked again and he saw that his guru was hanging on the ceiling. And he was speaking to his guru at this point, and his guru said, What would you like? Huh? What would you like the most? And he said, I would like some fruits from Kabul, right? And immediately he produced the fruits from Kabul just like that, a whole branch with fruits on it. Is that here? So he was performing some mystic feats. So oftentimes, mystic potency is being equalized with spiritual life. Mm-hmm. Prabhupada was, however, not displaying such kind of mystic potency. Mm-hmm. Although sometimes people thought he definitely had it, because he knew exactly what they were thinking. He was looking right into their hearts in a deep, penetrating way, and it made them think that he knew everything about them. And many times he was just giving the right answer for a person, exactly what they were thinking about. And then they were completely convinced, yes, he knows my thoughts. Mm-hmm. In this way, certainly it seemed that Prabhupada had mystic potency. But Prabhupada's greatest mystic potency is undoubtedly everything else he has achieved, right? All the temples that he created, all the books that he translated, and all the devotees that he made during his lifetime, and all the devotees that he's making still today. It is quite amazing that even after Prabhupada has left the planet, that his work is just carrying on. And that it is just going on as if he was still present. It seems in a way that Prabhupada is still present, but in other ways, unfortunately, we cannot just walk into his room to ask him a question. That would be nice if we could go to Prabhupada and ask him a question. Can you imagine how that would be? How nice? But that is not possible. So we have to look for answers in the books, and sometimes that's confusing because two people, they find contradicting answers to the same question, and then they argue with each other. And you get big debates over some point, and both are quoting Prabhupada left and right. One is 10 quotes, another is 10 quotes, and it's like a big duel that is being fought there. So how to understand Prabhupada when we are no longer able to go to his room? This question is certainly a big question. And wouldn't it be simple? Because if we look at ISKCON of 1966, when the movement was founded, and ISKCON of 1999, not only the numbers have turned upside down, but the whole movement has turned upside down. Right? Everything has changed completely. Right? It is a fact. From 66 to 99, it's inconceivable what happened. So, for one thing, in 66, there was great, great faith, but also some innocence and some naivety. People didn't know what they were going to do with their life, and they never thought about it. All they knew was Prabhupada, right? And Prabhupada will surely take care of us, guide us, and this is the greatest opportunity we ever had. We have the association of Prabhupada, a pure devotee, and what more is needed? Nothing more is needed. And this material world is for no other purpose than devotional service. We know it, and therefore we are not interested in making any arrangements for ourselves. We are simply going to preach Krishna consciousness, to please Prabhupada, because that's his desire. That we preach, that's it. That's what he wants, and nothing else. That pleases him so much when we just preach Krishna consciousness. And Prabhupada was with great pride saying, he said, yes, these Western boys and girls, they are not accustomed to live separate like brahmacharis and brahmacharini. Therefore, I make arrangements for them to get married. He said, but just see, these married couples, they have done more than the sannyasis of my Guru Maharaj. More than that. They went all over the world and preached, and that's how it was. Great faith. In 99, things are a little difficult, different to say the least, you know. It's come to the point where faith is down, the preaching spirit is less, the arrangements for life have become more important. Many considerations are there that you cannot just surrender everything to Krishna because you got to last a whole lifetime, and you got to be practical and realistic and better be honest about things. Right? This is the kind of thinking that is in the ether in the 90s, in the late 90s, at the turn of the millennium. So what are we going to do? Well, we are entering into a new millennium, the millennium of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu, the transcendental millennium. So this movement is meant for that. So the devotees of 66 had the right spirit, but not yet the experience. They were young and inexperienced, and they did not quite understand how to go on with it, how to do it for a lifetime. And therefore many of those from 66 have now turned into the ones of 99 and are living a much different life than they used to live then. So that may be the case, but still, the spirit of this movement is as it was originally understood, one for complete surrender to Krishna and for just giving everything at the same time. For some people that's not possible. And this movement is so broad that it gives shelter to everyone. everyone in this movement can somehow or other find a place in it. So if you can't surrender, if we can't surrender, no problem, then there's also a place for us. There is a place for everyone. But that doesn't mean that the purpose of this movement is to simply engage in some pious activity. This movement is for full surrender to Krishna and for nothing less. But if one cannot do that and one can only surrender a little bit, okay, that is the preliminary activity which will lead us to full surrender. So in that way, even that is still on the way to full surrender. In that way, this movement can offer a program for everyone. There was a group of people who approached Prabhupada, and one man wrote a letter and asked Prabhupada to become the chairman of the International Society for Christ Consciousness. And Prabhupada wrote a letter back, and he said that he was very honored that they had chosen him to become the chairman of the society, the International Society for Christ Consciousness. And Prabhupada said, yes, I'll be glad to accept that position, but there is one condition, and that is that the members of the society must follow the four regulative principles and chant the holy name of Christ. And if they do that, then I'll accept to become the chairman of that society. So I'm very broad-minded. Very, very broad-minded. Considering that the name of Christ came from Krista, as he explained many times, which was none different than the name from Krishna. Therefore he had faith that if that name was chanted, that ultimately the realization about Krishna would come. And that one at one point would understand that there was no difference between Christ consciousness and Krishna consciousness. Not in the sense that just we worship Christ and then everything is automatically revealed. No, but Prabhupada was ready to guide them. And by this chanting of the name, yes, everything can come. So, in this way, Prabhupada was able to unite all different kinds of people together in one movement. And he was able to work with people from all over the world. When Prabhupada came to Africa, in Kenya, where the devotees were preaching, they were preaching mostly to the Indians. And Prabhupada said, no, you should preach to the local Africans. They said, Prabhupada, that's very difficult. And Prabhupada didn't comment. But later, when they were in the temple, then Prabhupada said, open all the doors. Right? So the devotees opened all the doors, and Prabhupada started the kirtan, and within 10 minutes, the whole temple filled up with African people. And Prabhupada continued the kirtan for a long time with them, then gave a very short lecture, and said, now distribute prasad. He said, just see? It's very easy. And he showed them how to preach. So he was able to deal with all kinds of people from all over the world. The hippies of Haight-Ashbury in San Francisco, where Prabhupada went, were usually stoned on some drug or other. If they were not coming down from LSD, then they were trying just the regular marijuana. Whatever it was, they were never with their feet on the ground. But that didn't matter at all, because Prabhupada was ready to deal with them. And Prabhupada was ready to speak the truth to them. And he just told them basically that these drugs are not going to help you at all. They will not take you anywhere. But Prabhupada was ready to live with them, and people, they appreciated him. He was ready to help many people who had problems, the devotees. They had an open house, and anybody was brought there. It said in this Haight-Ashbury, the devotees started to cook for the people who were there, for all the hippies, and they cooked like for 200 people every day. And they just bagged all the foodstuffs, right? Anything, somehow or other, they bagged vegetables from the market and other things, and some people gave a little money, and in this way it was going on. It was not happening on the strength of a monthly budget, you know, that they knew we need so much money for 200 people every day times 30, makes so much per month for the feeding program and so much for the electricity bill and so much for the rent and so much for this, and then say, so we need this total amount. Where is it? No, they didn't operate like that. They just simply lived by the day, by the depending upon the mercy of Krishna, that somehow or other Krishna would help and Krishna would send someone to continue the program. And it did continue. It went on. It just went on. And in this way, on the strength of their enthusiasm, people became moved, just like the story of Magrari the Hunter. Magrari the Hunter was the one who half-killed animals who were lying there flapping still. As they were being shot, it was quite horrible. And it was Magrari who was told to change by Narada Muni, and Narada told him to break his bow. And then it was Narada Muni who arranged foodstuffs for the hunter, so he had said, and the hunter got more than he needed. So the hunter had faith. Why did the hunter get more than he needed? Because the people saw he had become a devotee and they all brought him something to eat. And in this way, he never had a shortage, although he had given up his bow. So somehow or other, this is the nature that if one surrenders to devotional service, to Krishna, some people in this world will become very impressed by that surrender. And some people in the world will support us. We need not be afraid. We need not think that how can we maintain, how can we convince the people, because some people are already convinced. They may not be completely in knowledge about Krishna, but they like spirituality. So such people, when they see the devotees, they will naturally be inclined to support the devotees. So they're already waiting for us, such people everywhere. The people that are going to support us, they were already waiting for us before this movement began. And before this movement comes into a town, the supporters are already there. And as soon as the devotees manifest themselves, there are some people who just like it, and some people who don't. This is the natural division within the universe. There are sura and asura, devotees and demons, everywhere. So therefore, preaching is not at all a complicated matter. Preaching is not a matter of how are we going to do it. Amarendra was a lawyer. Amarendra had been active in student movements in his university days, and Amarendra was by spirit a reformer. He wanted to change the world. So he asked Prabhupada in a feverish way. He said, how are we going to do it? How are we going to convince them? How are we going to convince them? And Prabhupada said, don't worry. Right? It doesn't take any new invention. We need not think of any special way. It is very simple. Just chant Hare Krishna and distribute prasad. Right? And everything will happen from there. Later, of course, he pointed out not only the regular mridanga, but also Brihat mridanga, which is the printing press, the great mridanga, and because that reaches further. So he added that, and with these ingredients, this movement will spread. And there where these things are taken wholeheartedly, without hesitation, where we make a sacrifice for this purpose, everything will come. Whether one is a sannyasi, whether one is a brahmachari, a vanaprastha, or a grihastha, it doesn't really matter. Right? Or whether one has no ashram at all, just like in Vrindavan, you know, our Indra, who's the famous singer, he says his ashram is a Brahmahastra Vanyasi. <Right? laughs> So, whatever that may be. He told me that. when I asked him what his ashram was. So, okay, whether you are any of the four or all four combined or nothing of the four, whatever we may be, it doesn't matter. The essence is that somehow or other we make time for sacrifice. And the sacrifice is only one in this age, preaching Krishna consciousness, somehow or other. That's it. There's no other sacrifice to make. Forget all other sacrifices. They're superseded. They are not the ones for this age. It's preaching. There's no way around it. Of course, one can preach according to his own ability, intelligence, and insights. That's possible. There are many ways to preach. So whatever one can do, or one can help the preachers. That's also being part of the preaching movement. So that is all right. But this preaching spirit should be there. So we should try and make the maximum time for that. Or we should try to make some substantial contribution to that. If we work in a business and we are busy making money from morning till night, that's okay, as long as we give some money to support this preaching mission. But if we don't do that, and we are not participating in that preaching mission, then how can we expect to go back home, back to Godhead? That is not possible. This is the yajna to be performed, and one cannot deny that. Whether it is 1966 or 1999, I'm aware that in 1999 there are many problems in people's minds that are not present in 1966. Right? I can understand that in 1966 everything was new and promising, and it was a success story because Prabhupada was there. And everything they did, it was perfect and transcendental. And the devotees were perfect and transcendental. They're like the devotees, the brahmacharis, they said there were no problems with the ladies, because in those days they thought that all the matajis were gopis. Right? So, like that, they thought everything was perfect, and therefore there was no problem with mixing with them because they were gopis. That was it. But now, of course, when time changed, right, ladies were seen as Maya. You know, saying, "Wow, they are all Maya," right, and these terrible emblems of Maya, you know, keep them behind a curtain or something. And in fact, there was some meeting amongst the brahmacharis in one temple where there was a proposal amongst all the men to send the ladies out of the temple during kirtan. Right? That was like the proposal. So one of the devotees said, no, how can we do that? Who will we have kirtan for? So in this way, it is a fact that in our movement, things changed since 66. But it's only the external form of the movement that changed. The substance hasn't changed a bit. It hasn't changed at all. It's the very same process. It's the very same material world. We are the very same conditioned souls. And it's the very same spiritual world where we have to go. Therefore, nothing has really changed from 66. It's exactly the same. Because this truth is the absolute truth, and it is true for all time, place, and circumstances, and it remains truth. So, therefore, the solutions for then are also the solutions for now. Chant Hare Krishna. Chant, dance, and take prasad. Right? That's it. That was the process then. It's still the process. Now, okay, everyone needs to sleep. And whether you want to sleep on the floor or whether you want to sleep on a water bed, that's up to you. Whether you want to sleep, with your pajamas on or with a dhoti on, or whether you want to sleep in a jogging suit, who cares, right? When you sleep, right? Whether you want to have golden buttons on your shirt or just regular buttons, it's entirely up to you. For whatever we do, we have to pay the price, right? If we want golden buttons, we have to pay a lot of money, and for that we have to do so many things to get it. If we have just cheap buttons, then they may break and, you know, we may lose them. And you have to have that austerity of living simple and with cheap things. In India, we really had an experience like that, especially in the past. Because to protect the Indian economy, during the years of the reign of Indira Gandhi, which was many, many years, they had a restriction on import. And anything imported, they charged 300-400% duty on that. So nothing could be imported, and therefore everything had to be locally made. And the Indians, they were very good in making things that looked exactly like things in the West. But they were not exactly like things in the West, right? Anything it looked like in the West, like you had a pair of socks and it looked just like a pair of real socks. And you put it on, and the first day they were like socks, but then the second day they looked like duck feet, you know? They had all become very white, and then the third day they were flapping around you and like this, and they were like bags on your feet, you know? I never knew how they got it together, but everything was like that. You know, in India, if you had a box of matches, it looked like a box of matches, but it didn't work like a box of matches, because you try to light one, you try to do like that, it broke. Then you try to do it the other way, it broke, you know. And any way you tried it, it broke. There's only one special trick, you know, to light Indian matches, which is like you had to really like hold the box like that, and then, you know, like the pulse, you know, you have to practice the pulse, and then, and like that special little effect, and then you just get it to burn. It's an art. Not under an angle, because then it will always break. It just has to be in such a way that it doesn't break. It's an art. Only professionals can do it, right? So anything in India was like that. You know, you had a door handle, it looked like a door handle, and then it would break off in your hand on the third day, right? Light switches would regularly fall out the wall, and anything could happen, you know. The strangest thing that ever happened to me is that when I turned on the light switch, I heard a gurgling sound, and then water came out. So anything was possible. So yes, simple living brings that with it, you know, that there are so many things that don't work so nicely. That's how it is. Right? That's simple living. And living with material facilities, of course, a little different. One has nice arrangements, etc. And everything is just perfect. Perfectly controlled atmosphere. So, whatever we want. We are very liberal. We are a liberal movement. So, we don't mind if one wants to live with a wife. And if both husband and wife want to put on golden crowns, that's fine. You can wear golden crowns if you like. We have no problem with it. And, you know, if you want to have, like, a golden bed to sleep in, you have our blessings, no problem. Just make sure you give a little bit to the deities as well, right? Like that. Everything is fine. We don't mind what we have. But the thing is, we must make sure that most of our energy is reserved for Krishna. This is the secret. Because at the end of life, we simply get the accrued result of all our activities. They add up, like the sum total. Yes, everything we've done in a lifetime adds up, and then you get at the end the total. Bing. There it is, the total. Right? And so we always have to make sure that in every single moment, the weight of what we offer to Krishna is a little more than what we offer to ourselves. Then we are safe. But if sometimes we take a little more for ourselves and a little less for Krishna, and then other times a little more for Krishna, a little more for ourselves, a little less for ourselves, like this, and we try to balance it out, then we may find that we had miscalculated the whole thing in the end, and that actually we did more for ourselves this lifetime than we did for Krishna. Right? It could happen by accident in that way. Then one will have to take another birth. That is the risk. So, whatever position we take, the bottom line is, from moment to moment, always make sure that we offer more to Krishna than that we take for ourselves. And this is the spirit. This is the spirit. And the Chaitanya Charitamrita, of course, is explaining that one should offer 50% of his wealth to the Supreme Lord. So it's at least 50%. That's 50-50. Right? And we see how there are examples of devotees who did that. Rupa Goswami, he had so much wealth, unlimited wealth, and he gave 50% to the Lord. So that was not easy, because when you have a lot to give everything, phew, that to give 50% when you have a lot, that hurts. And then there's another devotee named Kola Vechisridhar. Kola Vechisridhar was so poor, he had no income, and he was just going into the forest to the banana trees, and he was taking little pieces of the banana trees, and he was selling those for different purposes. The leaves of the banana trees in India are used as plates to eat from, and the barks are used again for other purposes. The flowers are even used for cooking vegetables. So like this, he had different items. Even the raw bananas can be used for cooking sabji, and the cooked bananas, etc. So whatever, he was selling these banana leaves. He made very little money from that, very little money. And he could therefore barely maintain. But he was never considering, never for a moment he was thinking that, well, today I really didn't make enough money to eat, so what can I do? It's an emergency, I cannot make any offering to the Lord today, but I'll surely do it tomorrow. No. He was spending 50% of whatever he earned on the worship of the Ganga. Because the Ganga comes from the lotus feet of the Lord, therefore every day he was worshipping the Ganga with 50% of his income, whether he had to eat or not, he didn't care. First the worship of the Ganga, and then the rest of his arrangements were being taken care of. And he was very, very poor, but he got very, very much mercy of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. Chaitanya Mahaprabhu always used to come to him, even when he was still young. And he used to come and he'd tell him, like, you, Sridhar, I know you have a whole lot of hidden wealth. You're hiding it from me, so you should give these cups for free, because I'm a Brahmin, and you should give them to me. And they would argue, and it was a whole thing. And this was going on forever. But then every day, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu would walk away with a gift. Sridhar would always give him a gift. He couldn't, and he became very attached to this. So in this way, he didn't know who Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was at the time, but he already had this service relationship with him. Then later, when he knew who Chaitanya Mahaprabhu was, then one day after a kirtan, Chaitanya Mahaprabhu came to the house of Sridhar and said, Sridhar, I am thirsty, give me some water. And Sridhar said, oh no, I don't have any water. He said, you have some water in that pot there. No, you cannot drink from my water pot, because Sridhar had only one water pot, and he was using this water pot for everything, for bathing, for even going into the field, and after that, what else did he have? She said, no, you cannot drink from this pot, but Chaitanya Mahaprabhu just snatched it and drank from that pot. And he said, ah, wonderful, this is delicious. So in this way, we see that the great devotees that are being glorified by the scriptures, that they did not base their life on material calculations. They did not consider that, like, well, I'm only earning so much, so what can I do? You know, I can't give 50%, but anyway, I'll give 10%, you know, because, I mean, when we start to earn more, I'll start giving 20%, and I'll try and strive for the ideal of 50%, but you know, what can I do? I cannot do it. Okay. I'm not criticizing anyone, if I say this. I'm not attacking anyone, right? But I'm just trying to, because I understand we are not like the eternal associates of Sri Chaitanya Mahaprabhu. I'm not on the platform of the eternal associates of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu either. So I'm not particularly singling out anyone, but I'm trying to remind us that the great devotees of Krishna, that they never had any material calculation. No material calculation. They calculated just spiritual principles, that's all. And they didn't consider the logic of the material world. And that spirit is the fully transcendental spirit. Such devotees, for such devotees, the Lord becomes personally active. The Lord, when he sees that his devotee with so much faith in him is surrendering and even not considering material advantage or disadvantage, then Krishna will personally come and change the whole situation into the advantage of the devotee. That's how it is. So if we are calculating everything according to the laws of material nature, then we cannot expect that the special mercy of Krishna will automatically come. But if we try everything for Krishna, everything we can possibly do, then certainly Krishna will be attracted. He will be attracted by our endeavor. And then the impossible will become possible. Just like that story of the sparrow who had lost her eggs by the ocean and who decided to drink up the ocean to get the eggs back. And then when Garuda heard of this, he became moved by it. And then Garuda said, I will help my little sister. And he came and he started to take up the mission of drinking up the ocean. Then Varuna very quickly appeared before him and said, No, please, please, I'll return these eggs, I'll find these. And within no time, the eggs were returned. So in the same way, we can attract the mercy of Krishna by our special endeavor. And then Krishna will, by his supernatural power, change the impossible to overcome material energy. And he'll make the impossible possible, because that's nothing for Krishna. And that is the principle of going back to Godhead. That is the principle. One who has that spirit of relying on Krishna, he is the eligible candidate to enter into the transcendental region of this movement. Now, we may look at this movement in different ways. On the surface of the movement, we see the social form of our movement. 66, a bunch of hippies from Haight-Ashbury are becoming devotees. They are still very much in that old culture. Stay high forever, they're saying, using drug language, calling Narada Muni a transcendental spaceman, because they are in the spirit of the 60s, right? Now, in the spirit of the 90s, things are different, and this movement has grown much different. But that's only on the surface, because underneath is the transcendental platform. We can say there's the form, and underneath there is the substance of the movement. Then in those layers, underneath the top layer, which is always changing and looking different, there are different layers we can see. One layer is the layer of the devotee, who is trying very much to come to the transcendental platform. That devotee is not considering the top layer, but he's just having his faith in Krishna and depending on Krishna. He's sincerely striving for perfection. He's the sadhaka. And then there's still another layer of this movement, and that is the ecstatic layer of the devotees who are completely transcendentally realized and who see everything, and for them, in a spiritual context, for them this movement is completely a transcendental experience. So we can see it in three layers. So I don't know how we are looking at this movement. But if we only look at the surface of this movement, yes, then we're seeing that, then some people say, ISKCON, it's not ISKCON anymore, it's ISKCON now. Or WASKCON, you know, they have different names for it. Yes, he said, ISKCON, no, it's not what it used to be. The good old days are no more, and all these things. But this is actually a material vision. Right? Even materially it's not true, but that's just a material perspective, because below the material perspective is the eternal substance of the transcendental process, which is always equally potent and can never be diminished in any way possible, and which is always accessible at all times. And therefore, there are always devotees who can, right now, see the pastimes of Chaitanya Mahaprabhu taking place, who can right now hear those kirtans in Srivasangam, hear that amazing transcendental sound vibration. It's possible to enter into that. Why not? We can hear it too, if we have faith. So it is all a matter of faith. When one approaches Lord Krishna with great faith, knowing that if we do make every sacrifice for his purpose, that he will surely fulfill all our desires, then he will surely fulfill our desires. Therefore, somehow or other, the preliminary process of devotional service is to bring us to that stage where we finally begin to desire to surrender to Krishna fully and to just fulfill his desire. And when we come to that point, then he will fulfill our desires. So, this is the transcendental platform. In this way, one will be freed from bondage to work and its auspicious and inauspicious result. With your mind fixed on me in this principle of renunciation, you will be liberated and come to me. That is the meaning of this verse. Any questions or comments?
Maharaj, do you like to give a comment? If one wants theoretically fully surrender, how it goes together with making plans? Should one make plans how one will surrender in long and in short term?
All right, so the question is, if we are surrendering and depending on Krishna, then how does that fit in with the principle of making plans? We must make plans for Krishna, not for ourselves. We don't make plans for ourselves, but we make plans for Krishna. Now we of course plan ourselves also into that for Krishna, because it's not that we are before the winter, we make a plan to have a good pair of shoes so that we can go out for Krishna. Otherwise, not that we say, well, Krishna will surely send some shoes, you know. He might, if we somehow or other cannot get any shoes. He may still send us some shoes, but we are not depending on Krishna as our order supplier. We are making plans and arrangements for our own facility, and we are making plans for spreading Krishna consciousness. We are making plans in the service of Krishna. And Krishna, he will sanction and he will frustrate different plans according to his likings. Right? But in the ultimate, Krishna will fulfill the plans for spreading Krishna consciousness in even a greater way than we could possibly ever have planned ourselves. Just as Prabhupada, when he first came to New York, Prabhupada said it was not logical that I was successful. He said because I was old, I was in a foreign country, coming with a message which was very foreign to the people. So how was it that I could be successful? Therefore, he said, I didn't quite know how this Krishna consciousness was going to spread. And I even considered that it might not work. And therefore, Prabhupada went and inquired regularly from the shipping company if there were boats going back as a consideration. But Prabhupada somehow or other continued. He saw some results, and ultimately he himself was very much overwhelmed by how Krishna had made him so successful. And this is the way Krishna acts, that ultimately if we make a plan for Krishna, he will test us, and sometimes our plan will not work, but we are determined to go on. He will test us again. Again, our plan will not work, but He wants to see how determined we are to go on. And when we still go on, then, in the end, our plan will be very, very successful. Then he will bless our plan. In such a case, one can fulfill all his desires. Yudhisthira Maharaj also is described as such a devotee who was, due to his surrender to Krishna, he was blessed to fulfill all his plans. Yeah. They're all plans for Krishna. So if one makes plans for Krishna, then he will be tested, but in the end, Krishna will allow the devotee to fulfill all his plans.
Maharaj, can Yukta Vairagya be pure bhakti, or is it Karma Mishra Bhakti or Jnana Mishra Bhakti?
Can Yukta Vairagya be pure bhakti, or is it Karma Mishra Bhakti? Karma Mishra means that we are doing things for our own enjoyment. And it says Karma Yoga is that yoga where I do what I like and then offer it to Krishna. That's Karma Yoga, Prabhupada explains. But Yukta Vairagya means that we use anything and everything that is favorable in the service for Krishna. We must use it, whether we like it or not. So in Yukta Vairagya we have to even offer the things that we don't like to Krishna. So Yukta Vairagya is completely selfless and transcendental if it is performed properly. And it should not have to have any trace of karma. But in Yukta Vairagya, in the name of Yukta Vairagya, one can actually do karma yoga by taking all kinds of material things which we happen to like very much, driving in the Mercedes and doing it for Krishna. Right? Yes, yes, I'm doing it all for Krishna. I'm enjoying it like anything, with 220 on the Autobahn in Germany. Yes, in a supercar for Krishna. That is the question. In that case, there may be more karma than yoga involved. So Yukta Vairagya means that we should not unnecessarily accept things. We should only accept things when they're necessary in the service of Krishna. Sometimes we were so enthusiastic about the Yukta part and not about the Vairagya part that we were very enthusiastic to accept everything and anything, but more for ourselves than for Krishna. So this is, of course, not desirable. So we should not perform karma yoga disguised as Yukta Vairagya. No. Real Yukta Vairagya means that we can employ everything, even this modern culture, and that we can even go into the streets and stand on the streets and distribute these books, right? Because that's all Yukta Vairagya. As I explained yesterday, we couldn't even have such books if we had no printing presses and no technology. So the Yukta Vairagya, as the fruit of all the technology, we can do mass book distribution. That is Yukta Vairagya. That's the Yukta Vairagya that Prabhupada wanted. So therefore, that we have to do, not karma yoga. So Yukta Vairagya should not be fruitive. It need not be. It can be purely transcendental. Any other question? Okay. Then I'll stop. Thank you very much. Srila Prabhupada ki jai.